to resent this injurious treatment of his bride, and he was gradually persuaded that Ingundis suffered for the cause of divine truth. Her tender complaints and the weighty arguments of Leander, Archbishop of Seville, accomplished his conversion, and the heir of the Gothic monarchy was initiated in the Nicene faith by the solemn rites of confirmation. The rash youth, inflamed by zeal and perhaps by ambition, was tempted to violate the duties of a son and a subject. And the Catholics of Spain, although they could not complain of persecution, applauded his pious rebellion against an heretical father. The civil war was protracted by the long and obstinate sieges of Mérida, Córdoba, and Seville, which had strenuously espoused the party of Hermenegild. He invited the Orthodox barbarians, the Suevi, and the Franks to the destruction of his native land. He solicited the dangerous aid of the Romans, who possessed Africa and a part of the Spanish coast, and his holy ambassador, the Archbishop Leander, effectually negotiated in person with the Byzantine court. But the hopes of the Catholics were crushed by the active diligence of the monarch who commanded the troops and treasures of Spain, and the guilty Hermenegild, after his vain attempts to resist or to escape, was compelled to surrender himself into the hands of an incensed father. Leo the Guilt was still mindful of that sacred character, and the rebel, despoiled of the regal ornaments, was still permitted in a decent exile to profess the Catholic religion. His repeated and unsuccessful treasons at length provoked the indignation of the Gothic king, and the sentence of death, which he pronounced with apparent reluctance, was privately executed in the Tower of Seville. The inflexible constancy with which he refused to accept the Arian communion as the price of his safety may excuse the honors that had been paid to the memory of Saint Hermenegild. His wife and infant son were detained by the Romans in ignominious captivity, and this domestic misfortune tarnished the glories of Leo the Guilt and embittered the last moments of his life. His son and successor, Recared, the first Catholic king of Spain, had imbibed the faith of his unfortunate brother, which he supported with more prudence and success. Instead of revolting against his father, Recared patiently expected the hour of his death. Instead of condemning his memory, he piously supposed that the dying monarch had abjured the errors of Arianism and recommended to his son the conversion of the Gothic nation. To accomplish that salutary end, Recared convened an assembly of the Arian clergy and nobles, declared himself a Catholic, and exhorted them to imitate the example of their prince. The laborious interpretation of doubtful texts or the curious pursuit of metaphysical arguments would have excited an endless controversy, and the monarch discreetly proposed to his illiterate audience two substantial and visible arguments, the testimony of earth and of heaven. The earth had submitted to the Nicene Synod. The Romans, the barbarians, and the inhabitants of Spain unanimously professed the same orthodox creed, and the Visigoths resisted almost alone the consent of the Christian world. A superstitious age was prepared to reverence as the testimony of heaven the preternatural causes which were performed by the skill or virtue of the Catholic clergy, the baptismal fonts of Osset in Bitica, which were spontaneously replenished every year on the vigil of Easter, and the miraculous shrine of St. Martin of Tours, which had already converted the Suevic prince and people of Galicia. The Catholic king encountered some difficulties on this important change of the national religion. A conspiracy secretly fomented by the Queen Dowager was formed against his life, and two counts excited a dangerous revolt in the Narbonnese Gaul. But Recared disarmed the conspirators, defeated the rebels, and executed severe justice, which the Arians in their turn might brand with the reproach of persecution. 8 bishops whose names betray their barbaric origin abjured their errors, and all the books of Arian theology were reduced to ashes, with the house in which they had been purposely collected. The whole body of the Visigoths and Suevi were allured or driven into the pale of the Catholic communion. The faith, at least of the rising generation, was fervent and sincere, and the devout liberality of the barbarians enriched the churches and monasteries of Spain. 70 bishops assembled in the Council of Toledo received the submission of their conquerors, and the zeal of the Spaniards improved the Nicene Creed by declaring the procession of the Holy Ghost from the Son as well as from the Father, a weighty point of doctrine which produced long afterwards the schism of the Greek and Latin churches. The royal proselyte immediately saluted and consulted Pope Gregory, surnamed the Great, a learned and holy prelate whose reign was distinguished by the conversion of heretics and infidels. The ambassadors of Recared respectfully offered on the threshold of the Vatican his rich presents of gold and gems. They accepted as a lucrative exchange the hairs of St. John the Baptist, a cross which enclosed a small piece of the true wood, and a key that contained some particles of iron which had been scraped from the chains of St. Peter. The same Gregory, the spiritual conqueror of Britain, encouraged the pious Theodelinda, queen of the Lombards, to propagate the Nicene faith among the victorious savages whose recent Christianity was polluted by the Arian heresy. Her devout labor still left room for the industry and success of future missionaries, and many cities of Italy were still disputed by hostile bishops. But the cause of Arianism was gradually suppressed by the weight of truth, of interest, and of example, and the controversy which Egypt had derived from the Platonic school was terminated after a war of 300 years by the final conversion of the Lombards of Italy. The first missionaries who preached the gospel to the barbarians appealed to the evidence of reason and claimed the benefit of toleration. But no sooner had they established their spiritual dominion than they exhorted the Christian kings to extirpate without mercy the remains of Roman or barbaric superstition. The successors of Clovis inflicted 100 lashes on the peasants who refused to destroy their idols. The crime of sacrificing to the demons was punished by the Anglo-Saxon laws with the heavier penalties of imprisonment and confiscation. And even the wise Alfred adopted as an indispensable duty the extreme rigor of the Mosaic institutions. But the punishment and the crime were gradually abolished among a Christian people. The theological disputes of the schools were suspended by propitious ignorance, and the intolerant spirit which could find neither idolaters nor heretics was reduced to the persecution of the Jews. That exiled nation had founded some synagogues in the cities of Gaul, but Spain, since the time of Hadrian, was filled with their numerous colonies. The wealth which they accumulated by trade and the management of the finances invited the pious avarice of their masters, and they might be oppressed without danger as they had lost the use and even the remembrance of arms. Sisebut, a Gothic king who reigned in the beginning of the 7th century, proceeded at once to the last extremes of persecution. 90,000 Jews were compelled to receive the sacrament of baptism. The fortunes of the obstinate infidels were confiscated, their bodies were tortured, and it seems doubtful whether they were permitted to abandon their native country. The excessive zeal of the Catholic king was moderated even by the clergy of Spain, who solemnly pronounced an inconsistent sentence, that the sacraments should not be forcibly imposed, but that the Jews who had been baptized should be constrained, for the honor of the Church, to persevere in the external practice of a religion which they disbelieved and detested. Their frequent relapses provoked one of the successors of Sisebut to banish the whole nation from his dominions, and a council of Toledo published a decree that every Gothic king should swear to maintain this salutary edict. but the tyrants were unwilling to dismiss the victims, whom they delighted to torture, or to deprive themselves of the industrious slaves over whom they might exercise a lucrative oppression. The Jews still continued in Spain under the weight of the civil and ecclesiastical laws which in the same country have been faithfully transcribed in the code of the Inquisition. The Gothic kings and bishops at length discovered that injuries will produce hatred, and that hatred will find the opportunity of revenge. A nation, the secret or professed enemies of Christianity, still multiplied in servitude and distress, and the intrigues of the Jews promoted the rapid success of the Arabian conquerors. As soon as the barbarians withdrew their powerful support, the unpopular heresy of Arius sunk into contempt and oblivion. But the Greeks still retained their subtle and loquacious disposition. The establishment of an obscure doctrine suggested new questions and new disputes, and it was always in the power of an ambitious prelate or a fanatic monk to violate the peace of the church and perhaps of the empire. The historian of the empire may overlook those disputes which were confined to the obscurity of schools and synods. The Manichaeans, who labored to reconcile the religions of Christ and of Zoroaster, had secretly introduced themselves into the provinces, but these foreign sectaries were involved in the common disgrace of the Gnostics, and the imperial laws were executed by the public hatred. The rational opinions of the Pelagians were propagated from Britain to Rome, Africa, and Palestine, and silently expired in a superstitious age. But the East was distracted by the Nestorian and Eutychian controversies, which attempted to explain the mystery of the Incarnation and hastened the ruin of Christianity in her native land. These controversies were first agitated under the reign of the younger Theodosius, but their important consequences extend far beyond the limits of the present volume. The metaphysical chain of argument, the contests of ecclesiastical ambition, and their political influence on the decline of the Byzantine Empire may afford an interesting and instructive series of history from the general councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon to the conquest of the East by the successors of Muhammad. Chapter 38. Reign and Conversion of Clovis. His victories over the Alemanni, Burgundians, and Visigoths. Establishment of the French monarchy in Gaul. Laws of the Barbarians. State of the Romans. The Visigoths of Spain. Conquest of Britain by the Saxons. Part 1. The Gauls, who impatiently supported the Roman yoke, received a memorable lesson from one of the lieutenants of Vespasian, whose weighty sense has been refined and expressed by the genius of Tacitus. The protection of the Republic has delivered Gaul from internal discord and foreign invasions. By the loss of national independence, you have acquired the name and privileges of Roman citizens. You enjoy in common with yourselves the permanent benefits of civil government, and your remote situation is less exposed to the accidental mischiefs of tyranny. Instead of exercising the rights of conquest, we have been contented to impose such tributes as are requisite for your own preservation. Peace cannot be secured without armies, and armies must be supported at the expense of the people. It is for your sake, not for our own, that we guard the barrier of the Rhine against the ferocious Germans, who have so often attempted and who will always desire to exchange the solitude of their woods and morasses for the wealth and fertility of Gaul. The fall of Rome would be fatal to the provinces, and you would be buried in the ruins of that mighty fabric which has been raised by the valor and wisdom of 800 years. Your imaginary freedom would be insulted and oppressed by savage master, and the expulsion of the Romans would be succeeded by the eternal hostilities of the barbarian conquerors. This salutary advice was accepted, and this strange prediction was accomplished. In the space of 400 years, the hardy Gauls, who had encountered the arms of Caesar, were imperceptibly melted into the general mass of citizens and subjects. The Western Empire was dissolved, and the Germans, who had passed the Rhine, fiercely contended for the possession of Gaul, and excited the contempt or abhorrence of its peaceful and polished inhabitants. With that conscious pride which the preeminence of knowledge and luxury seldom fails to inspire, they derided the hairy and gigantic savages of the north. Their rustic manners, dissonant joy, voracious appetite, and their horrid appearance, equally disgusting to the sight and to the smell. The liberal studies were still cultivated in the schools of Autun and Bordeaux, and the language of Cicero and Virgil was familiar to the Gallic youth. Their ears were astonished by the harsh and unknown sounds of the Germanic dialect, and they ingeniously lamented that the trembling muses fled from the harmony of a Burgundian lyre. The Gauls were endowed with all the advantages of art and nature, but as they wanted courage to defend them, they were justly condemned to obey and even to flatter the victorious barbarians by whose clemency they held their precarious fortunes and their lives. As soon as Odoacer had extinguished the Western Empire, he sought the friendship of the most powerful of the barbarians. The new sovereign of Italy resigned to Euric, king of the Visigoths, all the Roman conquests beyond the Alps as far as the Rhine and the ocean. And the Senate might confirm this liberal gift with some ostentation of power and without any real loss of revenue and dominion. The lawful pretensions of Euric were justified by ambition and success, and the Gothic nation might aspire under his command to the monarchy of Spain and Gaul. Arles and Marseille surrendered to his arms. He oppressed the freedom of Auvergne, and the bishop condescended to purchase his recall from exile by a tribute of just but reluctant praise. Sidonius waited before the gates of the palace among a crowd of ambassadors and suppliants, and their various business at the court of Bordeaux attested the power and the renown of the king of the Visigoths. The Heruli of the distant ocean, who painted their naked bodies with its cerulean color, implored his protection, and the Saxons respected the maritime provinces of a prince who was destitute of any naval force. The tall Burgundian submitted to his authority, nor did he restore the captive Franks, till he had imposed on that fierce nation the terms of an unequal peace. The Vandals of Africa cultivated his useful friendship, and the Ostrogoths of Pannonia were supported by his powerful aid against the oppression of the neighboring Huns. The North, such are the lofty strains of the poet, was agitated or appeased by the nod of Euric. The great king of Persia consulted the oracle of the West, and the aged god of the Tiber was protected by the swelling genius of the Garonne. The fortune of nations has often depended on accidents, and France may ascribe her greatness to the premature death of the Gothic king at a time when his son Alaric was a helpless infant and his adversary Clovis an ambitious and valiant youth. While Childeric, the father of Clovis, lived in exile in Germany, he was hospitably entertained by the queen as well as by the king of the Thuringians. After his restoration, Basina escaped from her husband's bed to the arms of her lover, freely declaring that if she had known a man wiser, stronger, or more beautiful than Childeric, that man should have been the object of her preference. Clovis was the offspring of this voluntary union, and when he was no more than 15 years of age, he succeeded by his father's death to the command of the Salian tribe. The narrow limits of his kingdom were confined to the island of the Batavians, with the ancient dioceses of Tournai and Arras. And at the baptism of Clovis, the number of his warriors could not exceed 5,000. The kindred tribes of the Franks, who had seated themselves along the Belgic rivers, the Scheldt, the Meuse, the Moselle, and the Rhine, were governed by their independent kings of the Merovingian race, the equals, the allies, and sometimes the enemies of the Salic prince. But the Germans, who obeyed in peace the hereditary jurisdiction of their chiefs, were free to follow the standard of a popular and victorious general, and the superior merit of Clovis attracted the respect and allegiance of the National Confederacy. When he first took the field, he had neither gold and silver in his coffers, nor wine and corn in his magazine. But he imitated the example of Caesar, who, in the same country, had acquired wealth by the sword and purchased soldiers with the fruits of conquest. After each successful battle or expedition, the spoils were accumulated in one common mass. Every warrior received his proportionable share, and the royal prerogative submitted to the equal regulations of military law. The untamed spirit of the barbarians was taught to acknowledge the advantages of regular discipline. At the annual review of the month of March, their arms were diligently inspected, and when they traversed a peaceful territory, they were prohibited from touching a blade of grass. The justice of Clovis was inexorable, and his careless or disobedient soldiers were punished with instant death. It would be superfluous to praise the valor of a Frank, but the valor of Clovis was directed by cool and consummate prudence. In all his transactions with mankind, he calculated the weight of interest, of passion, and of opinion, and his measures were sometimes adapted to the sanguinary manners of the Germans, and sometimes moderated by the milder genius of Rome and Christianity. He was intercepted in the career of victory, since he died in the 45th year of his age, but he had already accomplished in a reign of 30 years the establishment of the French monarchy in Gaul. The first exploit of Clovis was the defeat of Syagrius, the son of Aegidius, and the public quarrel might on this occasion be inflamed by private resentment. The glory of the father still insulted the Merovingian race. The power of the son might excite the jealous ambition of the king of the Franks. Syagrius inherited as a patrimonial estate the city and diocese of Soissons, the desolate remnant of the second Belgic, Reims and Troyes, Beauvais and Amiens, would naturally submit to the count or patrician, and after the dissolution of the Western Empire, he might reign with the title, or at least with the authority, of King of the Romans. As a Roman, he had been educated in the liberal studies of rhetoric and jurisprudence, but he was engaged by accident and policy in the familiar use of the Germanic idiom. The independent barbarians resorted to the tribunal of a stranger who possessed the singular talent of explaining in their native tongue the dictates of reason and equity. The diligence and affability of their judge rendered him popular. The impartial wisdom of his decrees obtained their voluntary obedience. And the reign of Syagrius over the Franks and Burgundians seemed to revive the original institution of civil society. In the midst of these peaceful occupations, Syagrius received and boldly accepted the hostile defiance of Clovis, who challenged his rival in the spirit and almost in the language of chivalry to appoint the day and the field of battle. In the time of Caesar, Soissons would have poured forth a body of 50,000 horse, and such an army might have been plentifully supplied with shields, cuirasses, and military engines from the 3 arsenals or manufactures of the city. But the courage and numbers of the Gallic youth were long since exhausted, and the loose bands of volunteers or mercenaries who marched under the standard of Syagrius were incapable of contending with the national valor of the Franks. It would be ungenerous without some more accurate knowledge of his strength and resources to condemn the rapid flight of Syagrius, who escaped after the loss of a battle to the distant court of Toulouse. The feeble minority of Alaric could not assist or protect an unfortunate fugitive. The pusillanimous Goths were intimidated by the menaces of Clovis, and the Roman king, after a short confinement, was delivered into the hands of the executioner. The Belgic cities surrendered to the king of the Franks, and his dominions were enlarged towards the east by the ample diocese of Tongres, which Clovis subdued in the 10th year of his reign. The name of the Alemanni has been absurdly derived from their imaginary settlement on the banks of the Leermann Lake, that fortunate district from the lake to the Avanche and Mount Jura was occupied by the Burgundians. The northern parts of Helvetia had indeed been subdued by the ferocious Alemanni, who destroyed with their own hands the fruits of their conquest. A province, improved and adorned by the arts of Rome, was again reduced to a savage wilderness, and some vestige of the stately Vindonissa may still be discovered in the fertile and populous valley of the Ahr. From the source of the Rhine to its conflux with the Main and the Moselle, the formidable swarms of the Alemanni commanded either side of the river by the right of ancient possession or recent victory. They had spread themselves into Gaul over the modern provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, and their bold invasion of the kingdom of Cologne summoned the Salic prince to the defense of his Ripuarian allies. Clovis encountered the invaders of Gaul in the plain of Tolbiac, about 24 miles from Cologne, and the two fiercest nations of Germany were mutually animated by the memory of past exploits and the prospect of future greatness. The Franks, after an obstinate struggle, gave way, and the Alemanni, raising a shout of victory, impetuously pressed their retreat. But the battle was restored by the valor and the conduct, and perhaps by the piety, of Clovis, and the event of the bloody day decided forever the alternative of empire or servitude. The last king of the Alemanni was slain in the field, and his people were slaughtered or pursued till they threw down their arms and yielded to the mercy of the conqueror. Without discipline, it was impossible for them to rally. They had contemptuously demolished the walls and fortifications which might have protected their distress, and they were followed into the heart of their forests by an enemy not less active or intrepid than themselves. The great Theodoric congratulated the victory of Clovis, whose sister, Albofleda, the king of Italy, had lately married. But he mildly interceded with his brother in favor of the suppliants and fugitives who had implored his protection. The Gallic territories, which were possessed by the Alemanni, became the prize of their conqueror, and the haughty nation, invincible or rebellious to the arms of Rome, acknowledged the sovereignty of the Merovingian kings, who graciously permitted them to enjoy their peculiar manners and institutions under the government of official and, at length, of hereditary dukes. After the conquest of the western provinces, the Franks alone maintained their ancient habitations beyond the Rhine. They gradually subdued and civilized the exhausted countries as far as the Elbe and the mountains of Bohemia, and the peace of Europe was secured by the obedience of Germany. Till the 30th year of his age, Clovis continued to worship the gods of his ancestors. His disbelief, or rather disregard, of Christianity might encourage him to pillage with less remorse the churches of a hostile territory, but his subjects of Gaul enjoyed the free exercise of religious worship, and the bishops entertained a more favorable hope of the idolater than of the heretics. The Merovingian prince had contracted a fortunate alliance with the fair Clotilde, the niece of the king of Burgundy, who, in the midst of an Arian court, was educated in the profession of the Catholic faith. It was her interest, as well as her duty, to achieve the conversion of a pagan husband, and Clovis insensibly listened to the voice of love and religion. He consented, perhaps such terms had been previously stipulated, to the baptism of his eldest son, and though the sudden death of the infant excited some superstitious fears, he was persuaded a second time to repeat the dangerous experiment. In the distress of the Battle of Tolbiac, Clovis loudly invoked the god of Clotilda and the Christians, and victory disposed him to hear with respectful gratitude the eloquent Remigius, Bishop of Reims, who forcibly displayed the temporal and spiritual advantages of his conversion. The king declared himself satisfied of the truth of the Catholic faith, and the political reasons which might have suspended his public profession were removed by the devout or loyal acclamations of the Franks, who showed themselves alike prepared to follow their heroic leader to the field of battle or to the baptismal font. The important ceremony was performed in the Cathedral of Reims, with every circumstance of magnificence and solemnity that could impress an awful sense of religion on the minds of its rude proselytes. The new Constantine was immediately baptized with 3,000 of his warlike subjects, and their example was imitated by the remainder of the gentle barbarians, who, in obedience to the victorious prelate, adored the cross which they had burnt, and burnt the idols which they had formerly adored. The mind of Clovis was susceptible of transient fervor. He was exasperated by the pathetic tale of the passion and death of Christ, and instead of weighing the salutary consequences of that mysterious sacrifice, he exclaimed with indiscreet fury, "Had I been present at the head of my valiant Franks, I would have revenged his injuries." But the savage conqueror of Gaul was incapable of examining the proofs of a religion which depends on the laborious investigation of historic evidence and speculative theology. He was still more incapable of feeling the mild influence of the gospel, which persuades and purifies the heart of a genuine convert. His ambitious reign was a perpetual violation of moral and Christian duties. His hands were stained with blood in peace as well as in war, and as soon as Clovis had dismissed a synod of the Gallican Church, he calmly assassinated all the princes of the Merovingian race. Yet the king of the Franks might sincerely worship the Christian God as a being more excellent and powerful than his national deities, and the signal deliverance and victory of Tolbiac encouraged Clovis to confide in the future protection of the Lord of Hosts. Martin, the most popular of the saints, had filled the Western world with the fame of those miracles which were incessantly performed at his holy sepulchre of Tours. His visible or invisible aid promoted the cause of a liberal and orthodox prince, and the profane remark of Clovis himself that St. Martin was an expensive friend need not be interpreted as the symptom of any permanent or rational skepticism. But earth, as well as heaven, rejoiced in the conversion of the Franks. On the memorable day when Clovis ascended from the baptismal font, he alone, in the Christian world, deserved the name and prerogatives of a Catholic king. The Emperor Anastasius entertained some dangerous errors concerning the nature of the divine incarnation, and the barbarians of Italy, Africa, Spain, and Gaul were involved in the Arian heresy. The eldest, or rather the only, son of the Church was acknowledged by the clergy as their lawful sovereign, or glorious deliverer, and the armies of Clovis were strenuously supported by the zeal and fervor of the Catholic faction. Under the Roman Empire, the wealth and jurisdiction of the bishops, their sacred character and perpetual office, their numerous dependents, popular eloquence, and provincial assemblies had rendered them always respectable and sometimes dangerous. Their influence was augmented with the progress of superstition, and the establishment of the French monarchy may, in some degree, be ascribed to the firm alliance of 100 prelates who reigned in the discontented or independent cities of Gaul. The slight foundations of the Armorican Republic had been repeatedly shaken or overthrown, but the same people still guarded their domestic freedom, asserted the dignity of the Roman name, and bravely resisted the predatory inroads and regular attacks of Clovis, who labored to extend his conquests from the Seine to the Loire. Their successful opposition introduced an equal and honorable union. The Franks esteemed the valour of the Armoricans, and the Armoricans were reconciled by the religion of the Franks. The military force which had been stationed for the defence of Gaul consisted of 100 different bands of cavalry or infantry, and these troops, while they assumed the title and privileges of Roman soldiers, were renewed by an incessant supply of the barbarian youth. The extreme fortifications and scattered fragments of the empire were still defended by their hopeless courage, but their retreat was intercepted, and their communication was impracticable. They were abandoned by the Greek princes of Constantinople, and they piously disclaimed all connection with the Arian usurpers of Gaul. They accepted, without shame or reluctance, the generous capitulation which was proposed by a Catholic hero, and this spurious or legitimate progeny of the Roman legions was distinguished in the succeeding age by their arms, their ensigns, and their peculiar dress and institutions. But the national strength was increased by these powerful and voluntary accessions, and the neighbouring kingdoms dreaded the numbers as well as the spirit of the Franks. The reduction of the northern provinces of Gaul, instead of being decided by the chance of a single battle, appears to have been slowly effected by the gradual operation of war and treaty, and Clovis acquired each object of his ambition by such efforts or such concessions as were adequate to its real value. His savage character and the virtues of Henry IV suggest the most opposite ideas of human nature. Yet some resemblance may be found in the situation of two princes who conquered France by their valour, their policy, and the merits of a seasonable conversion. The kingdom of the Burgundians, which was defined by the course of two Gallic rivers, the Saone and the Rhone, extended from the forest of the Vosges to the Alps and the Sea of Marseille. The scepter was in the hands of Gundobald. That valiant and ambitious prince had reduced the number of royal candidates by the death of two brothers, one of whom was the father of Clotilde. But his imperfect prudence still permitted Godegesil, the youngest of his brothers, to possess the dependent principality of Geneva. The Arian monarch was justly alarmed by the satisfaction and the hopes which seemed to animate his clergy and people after the conversion of Clovis, and Gundobald convened at Lyon an assembly of his bishops to reconcile, if it were possible, their religious and political discontents. A vain conference was agitated between the two factions. The Arians upbraided the Catholics with the worship of three gods. The Catholics defended their cause by theological distinctions, and the usual arguments, objections, and replies were reverberated with obstinate clamour, till the king revealed his secret apprehensions by an abrupt but decisive question, which he addressed to the Orthodox bishops. "If you truly profess the Christian religion, why do you not restrain the king of the Franks? He has declared war against me and forms alliances with my enemies for my destruction. A sanguinary and covetous mind is not the symptom of a sincere conversion. Let him show his faith by his works." The answer of Avitus, Bishop of Vienna, who spoke in the name of his brethren, was delivered with the voice and countenance of an angel. "We are ignorant of the motives and intentions of the King of the Franks, but we are taught by Scripture that the kingdoms which abandon the divine law are frequently subverted, and that enemies will arise on every side against those who have made God their enemy. Return with thy people to the law of God, and he will give peace and security to thy dominions." The king of Burgundy, who was not prepared to accept the condition which the Catholics considered as essential to the treaty, delayed and dismissed the ecclesiastical conference after reproaching his bishops that Clovis, their friend and proselyte, had privately tempted the allegiance of his brother. Part 2. The allegiance of his brother was already seduced. and the obedience of Goregisil, who joined the royal standard with the troops of Geneva, more effectually promoted the success of the conspiracy. While the Franks and Burgundians contended with equal valour, his seasonable desertion decided the event of the battle, and as Gundobald was faintly supported by the disaffected Gauls, he yielded to the arms of Clovis and hastily retreated from the field, which appears to have been situated between Langres and Dijon. He distrusted the strength of Dijon, a quadrangular fortress encompassed by two rivers and by a wall 30 feet high and 15 thick, with 4 gates and 33 towers. He abandoned to the pursuit of Clovis the important cities of Lyon and Vienna, and Gundobald still fled with precipitation till he had reached Avignon at the distance of 250 miles from the field of battle. A long siege and an artful negotiation admonished the king of the Franks of the danger and difficulty of his enterprise. He imposed a tribute on the Burgundian prince, compelled him to pardon and reward his brother's treachery, and proudly returned to his own dominions with the spoils and captives of the southern provinces. This splendid triumph was soon clouded by the intelligence that Gundobald had violated his recent obligations, and that the unfortunate Goregisil, who was left at Vienna with a garrison of 5,000 Franks, had been besieged, surprised, and massacred by his inhuman brother. Such an outrage might have exasperated the patience of the most peaceful sovereign, yet the conqueror of Gaul dissembled the injury, released the tribute, and accepted the alliance and military service of the King of Burgundy. Clovis no longer possessed those advantages which had assured the success of the preceding war, and his rival, instructed by adversity, had found new resources in the affections of his people. The Gauls, or Romans, applauded the mild and impartial laws of Gundobald, which almost raised them to the same level with their conquerors. The bishops were reconciled and flattered by the hopes which he artfully suggested of his approaching conversion. And though he eluded their accomplishment to the last moment of his life, his moderation secured the peace and suspended the ruin of the kingdom of Burgundy. I am impatient to pursue the final ruin of that kingdom which was accomplished under the reign of Sigismund, the son of Gundobald. The Catholic Sigismund has acquired the honors of a saint and martyr, but the hands of the royal saint were stained with the blood of his innocent son, whom he inhumanly sacrificed to the pride and resentment of a stepmother. He soon discovered his error and bewailed the irreparable loss. While Sigismund embraced the corpse of the unfortunate youth, he received a severe admonition from one of his attendants. "It is not his situation, O king, it is thine which deserves pity and lamentation." The reproaches of a guilty conscience were alleviated, however, by his liberal donations to the monastery of Agaunum, or St. Maurice in Valais, which he himself had founded in honor of the imaginary martyrs of the Theban Legion. A full chorus of perpetual psalmody was instituted by the pious king. He assiduously practiced the austere devotion of the monks, and it was his humble prayer that heaven would inflict in this world the punishment of his sins. His prayer was heard, the avengers were at hand, and the provinces of Burgundy were overwhelmed by an army of victorious Franks. After the event of an unsuccessful battle, Sigismund, who wished to protract his life that he might prolong his penance, concealed himself in the desert in a religious habit, till he was discovered and betrayed by his subjects, who solicited the favor of their new masters. The captive monarch, with his wife and 2 children, was transported to Orléans, and buried alive in a deep well by the stern command of the sons of Clovis, whose cruelty might derive some excuse from the maxims and examples of their barbarous age. Their ambition, which urged them to achieve the conquest of Burgundy, was inflamed or disguised by filial piety, and Clotilda, whose sanctity did not consist in the forgiveness of injuries, pressed them to revenge her father's death on the family of his assassin. The rebellious Burgundians, for they attempted to break their chains, were still permitted to enjoy their national laws under the obligation of tribute and military service, and the Merovingian princes peaceably reigned over a kingdom whose glory and greatness had been first overthrown by the arms of Clovis. The first victory of Clovis had insulted the honour of the Goths. They viewed his rapid progress with jealousy and terror, and the youthful fame of Alaric was oppressed by the more potent genius of his rival. Some disputes inevitably arose on the edge of their contiguous dominions, and after the delays of fruitless negotiation, a personal interview of the two kings was proposed and accepted. The conference of Clovis and Alaric was held in a small island of the Loire near Amboise. They embraced, familiarly conversed, and feasted together, and separated with the warmest professions of peace and brotherly love. But their apparent confidence concealed a dark suspicion of hostile and treacherous designs, and their mutual complaints solicited, eluded, and disclaimed a final arbitration. At Paris, which he already considered as his royal seat, Clovis declared to an assembly of the princes and warriors the pretense and motive of a Gothic war. "It grieves me to see that the Arians still possess the fairest portion of Gaul. Let us march against them with the aid of God, and having vanquished the heretics, we will possess and divide their fertile provinces." The Franks, who were inspired by hereditary valour and recent zeal, applauded the generous design of their monarch, expressed their resolution to conquer or die, since death and conquest would be equally profitable, and solemnly protested that they would never shave their beards till victory should absolve them from that inconvenient vow. The enterprise was promoted by the public or private exhortations of Clotilda. She reminded her husband how effectually some pious foundation would propitiate the deity and his servants, and the Christian hero, darting his battle-axe with a skillful and nervous hand, "There," said he, "on that spot where my Francisca shall fall, will I erect a church in honour of the holy apostles." This ostentatious piety confirmed and justified the attachment of the Catholics, with whom he secretly corresponded, and their devout wishes were gradually ripened into a formidable conspiracy. The people of Aquitaine were alarmed by the indiscreet reproaches of their Gothic tyrants, who justly accused them of preferring the dominion of the Franks, and their zealous adherent Quintianus, bishop of Rodez, preached more forcibly in his exile than in his diocese. To resist these foreign and domestic enemies who were fortified by the alliance of the Burgundians, Alaric collected his troops, far more numerous than the military powers of Clovis. The Visigoths resumed the exercise of arms which they had neglected in a long and luxurious peace. A select band of valiant and robust slaves attended their masters to the field, and the cities of Gaul were compelled to furnish their doubtful and reluctant aid. Theodoric, king of the Ostrogoths, who reigned in Italy, had labored to maintain the tranquility of Gaul, and he assumed, or affected for that purpose, the impartial character of a mediator. But the sagacious monarch dreaded the rising empire of Clovis, and he was firmly engaged to support the national and religious cause of the Goths. The accidental or artificial prodigies which adorned the expedition of Clovis were accepted by a superstitious age as the manifest declaration of the divine favour. He marched from Paris, and as he proceeded with decent reverence through the holy diocese of Tours, his anxiety tempted him to consult the shrine of St. Martin, the sanctuary and the oracle of Gaul. His messengers were instructed to remark the words of the psalm which should happen to be chanted at the precise moment when they entered the church. Those words most fortunately expressed the valour and victory of the champions of heaven, and the application was easily transferred to the new Joshua the new Gideon, who went forth to battle against the enemies of the Lord. Orleans secured to the Franks a bridge on the Loire, but at the distance of 40 miles from Poitiers, their progress was intercepted by an extraordinary swell of the river Vigena, or Vienne, and the opposite banks were covered by the encampment of the Visigoths. Delay must be always dangerous to barbarians, who consume the country through which they march. And had Clovis possessed leisure and materials, it might have been impracticable to construct a bridge, or to force a passage in the face of a superior enemy. But the affectionate peasants who were impatient to welcome their deliverer could easily betray some unknown or unguarded ford. The merit of the discovery was enhanced by the useful interposition of fraud or fiction, and a white hart of singular size and beauty appeared to guide and animate the march of the Catholic army. The councils of the Visigoths were irresolute and distracted. A crowd of impatient warriors, presumptuous in their strength and disdaining to fly before the robbers of Germany, excited Alaric to assert in arms the name and blood of the conquerors of Rome. The advice of the graver chieftains pressed him to elude the first ardour of the Franks, and to expect in the southern provinces of Gaul the veteran and victorious Ostrogoths, whom the king of Italy had already sent to his assistance. The decisive moments were wasted in idle deliberation. The Goths too hastily abandoned, perhaps, an advantageous post, and the opportunity of a secure retreat was lost by their slow and disorderly motions. After Clovis had passed the ford, as it is still named, of the Hart, he advanced with bold and hasty steps to prevent the escape of the enemy. His nocturnal march was directed by a flaming meteor suspended in the air above the cathedral of Poitiers, and this signal, which might be previously concerted with the orthodox successor of St. Hilary, was compared to the column of fire that guided the Israelites in the desert. At the third hour of the day, about 10 miles beyond Poitiers, Clovis overtook and instantly attacked the Gothic army, whose defeat was already prepared by terror and confusion. Yet they rallied in their extreme distress, and the martial youths who had clamorously demanded the battle refused to survive the ignominy of flight. The two kings encountered each other in single combat. Alaric fell by the hand of his rival, and the victorious Frank was saved by the goodness of his cuirass and the vigor of his horse from the spears of two desperate Goths, who furiously rode against him to revenge the death of their sovereign. The vague expression of a mountain of the slain serves to indicate a cruel, though indefinite, slaughter. But Gregory has carefully observed that his valiant countryman, Apollinaris, the son of Sidonius, lost his life at the head of the nobles of Auvergne. Perhaps these suspected Catholics had been maliciously exposed to the blind assault of the enemy, and perhaps the influence of religion was superseded by personal attachment or military honour. Such is the empire of fortune, if we may still disguise our ignorance under that popular name, that it is almost equally difficult to foresee the events of war or to explain their various consequences. A bloody and complete victory has sometimes yielded no more than the possession of the field, and the loss of 10,000 men has sometimes been sufficient to destroy in a single day the work of ages. The decisive battle of Poitiers was followed by the conquest of Aquitaine. Alaric had left behind him an infant son, a bastard competitor, factious nobles, and a disloyal people. And the remaining forces of the Goths were oppressed by the general consternation or opposed to each other in civil discord. The victorious king of the Franks proceeded without delay to the siege of Angoulême. At the sound of his trumpets, the walls of the city imitated the example of Jericho and instantly fell to the ground. A splendid miracle, which may be reduced to the supposition that some clerical engineers had secretly undermined the foundations of the rampart. At Bordeaux, which had submitted without resistance, Clovis established his winter quarters, and his prudent economy transported from Toulouse the royal treasures which were deposited in the capital of the monarchy. The conqueror penetrated as far as the confines of Spain, restored the honors of the Catholic Church, fixed in Aquitaine a colony of Franks, and delegated to his lieutenants the easy task of subduing or extirpating the nation of the Visigoths. But the Visigoths were protected by the wise and powerful monarch of Italy. While the balance was still equal, Theodoric had perhaps delayed the march of the Ostrogoths, but their strenuous efforts successfully resisted the ambition of Clovis, and the army of the Franks and their Burgundian allies was compelled to raise the siege of Arles, with the loss, as it is said, of 30,000 men. These vicissitudes inclined the fierce spirit of Clovis to acquiesce in an advantageous treaty of peace. The Visigoths were suffered to retain the possession of Septimania, a narrow tract of seacoast from the Rhone to the Pyrenees, but the ample province of Aquitaine, from those mountains to the Loire, was indissolubly united to the kingdom of France. After the success of the Gothic War, Clovis accepted the honors of the Roman consulship. The Emperor Anastasius ambitiously bestowed on the most powerful rival of Theodoric the title and ensigns of that eminent dignity. Yet from some unknown cause, the name of Clovis has not been inscribed in the fasti either of the East or West. On the solemn day, the monarch of Gaul, placing a diadem on his head, was invested in the church of St. Martin with a purple tunic and mantle. From thence he proceeded on horseback to the Cathedral of Tours, and as he passed through the streets, profusely scattered with his own hand a donative of gold and silver to the joyful multitude who incessantly repeated their acclamations of Consul and Augustus. The actual or legal authority of Clovis could not receive any new accessions from the consular dignity. It was a name, a shadow, an empty pageant. And if the conqueror had been instructed to claim the ancient prerogatives of that high office, they must have expired with the period of its annual duration. But the Romans were disposed to revere in the person of their master that antique title which the emperors condescended to assume. The barbarian himself seemed to contract a sacred obligation to respect the majesty of the Republic, and the successors of Theodosius, by soliciting his friendship, tacitly forgave and almost ratified the usurpation of Gaul. 25 years after the death of Clovis, this important concession was more formally declared in a treaty between his sons and the Emperor Justinian. The Ostrogoths of Italy, unable to defend their distant acquisitions, had resigned to the Franks the cities of Arles and Marseille, of Arles still adorned with the seat of a praetorian prefect, and of Marseille enriched by the advantages of trade and navigation. This transaction was confirmed by the imperial authority, and Justinian, generously yielding to the Franks the sovereignty of the countries beyond the Alps, which they already possessed, absolved the provincials from their allegiance, and established on a more lawful, though not more solid foundation, the throne of the Merovingians. From that era they enjoyed the right of celebrating at Arles the games of the circus, and by singular privilege which was denied even to the Persian monarch, the gold coin impressed with their name and image obtained a legal currency in the empire. A Greek historian of that age has praised the private and public virtues of the Franks with a partial enthusiasm which cannot be sufficiently justified by their domestic annals. He celebrates their politeness and urbanity, their regular government and orthodox religion, and boldly asserts that these barbarians could be distinguished only by their dress and language from the subjects of Rome. Perhaps the Franks already displayed the social disposition and lively graces which in every age have disguised their vices and sometimes concealed their intrinsic merit. Perhaps Agathias and the Greeks were dazzled by the rapid progress of their arms and the splendor of their empire. Since the conquest of Burgundy, Gaul, except the Gothic province of Septimania, was subject in its whole extent to the sons of Clovis. They had extinguished the German kingdom of Thuringia, and their vague dominion penetrated beyond the Rhine into the heart of their native forests. The Alemanni and Bavarians, who had occupied the Roman provinces of Rhaetia and Noricum to the south of the Danube, confessed themselves the humble vassals of the Franks, and the feeble barrier of the Alps was incapable of resisting their ambition. When the last survivor of the sons of Clovis united the inheritance and conquests of the Merovingians, his kingdom extended far beyond the limits of modern France. Yet modern France, such has been the progress of arts and policy, far surpasses in wealth, populousness, and power the spacious but savage realms of Clotaire or Dagobert. The Franks, or French, are the only people of Europe who can deduce a perpetual succession from the conquerors of the Western Empire. But their conquest of Gaul was followed by 10 centuries of anarchy and ignorance. On the revival of learning, the students who had been formed in the schools of Athens and Rome disdained their barbarian ancestors, and a long period elapsed before patient labor could provide the requisite materials to satisfy, or rather to excite, the curiosity of more enlightened times. At length the eye of criticism and philosophy was directed to the antiquities of France, but even philosophers have been tainted by the contagion of prejudice and passion. The most extreme and exclusive systems of the personal servitude of the Gauls, or of their voluntary and equal alliance with the Franks, have been rashly conceived and obstinately defended, and the intemperate disputants have accused each other of conspiring against the prerogative of the crown, the dignity of the nobles, or the freedom of the people. Yet the sharp conflict has usefully exercised the adverse powers of learning and genius, and each antagonist, alternately vanquished and victorious, has extirpated some ancient errors and established some interesting truths. An impartial stranger, instructed by their discoveries, their disputes, and even their faults, may describe from the same original materials the state of the Roman provincials after Gaul had submitted to the arms and laws of the Merovingian kings. The rudest or the most servile condition of human society is regulated, however, by some fixed and general rules. When Tacitus surveyed the primitive simplicity of the Germans, he discovered some permanent maxims or customs of public and private life which were preserved by faithful tradition till the introduction of the art of writing and of the Latin tongue. Before the election of the Merovingian kings, the most powerful tribe or nation of the Franks appointed 4 venerable chieftains to compose the Salic laws, and their labors were examined and approved in 3 successive assemblies of the people. After the baptism of Clovis, he reformed several articles that appeared incompatible with Christianity. The Salic law was again amended by his sons, and at length, under the reign of Dagobert, the code was revised and promulgated in its actual form, 100 years after the establishment of the French monarchy. Within the same period, the customs of the Ripuarians were transcribed and published, and Charlemagne himself, the legislator of his age and country, had accurately studied the 2 national laws which still prevailed among the Franks. The same care was extended to their vassals, and the rude institutions of the Alemanni and Bavarians were diligently compiled and ratified by the supreme authority of the Merovingian kings. The Visigoths and Burgundians, whose conquests in Gaul preceded those of the Franks, showed less impatience to attain one of the principal benefits of civilized society. Euric was the first of the Gothic princes who expressed in writing the manners and customs of his people, and the composition of the Burgundian laws was a measure of policy rather than of justice, to alleviate the yoke and regain the affections of their Gallic subjects. Thus, by singular coincidence, the Germans framed their artless institutions at a time when the elaborate system of Roman jurisprudence was finally consummated. In the Salic laws and the Pandects of Justinian, we may compare the first rudiments and the full maturity of civil wisdom. And whatever prejudices may be suggested in favor of barbarism, our calmer reflections will ascribe to the Romans the superior advantages not only of science and reason, but of humanity and justice. Yet the laws of the barbarians were adapted to their wants and desires, their occupations and their capacity, and they all contributed to preserve the peace and promote the improvement of the society for whose use they were originally established. The Merovingians, instead of imposing a uniform rule of conduct on their various subjects, permitted each people and each family of their empire freely to enjoy their domestic institutions. Nor were the Romans excluded from the common benefits of this legal toleration. The children embraced the law of their parents, the wife that of her husband, the freedman that of his patron. And in all causes where the parties were of different nations, the plaintiff or accuser was obliged to follow the tribunal of the defendant, who may always plead a judicial presumption of right or innocence. A more ample latitude was allowed if every citizen in the presence of the judge might declare the law under which he desired to live and the national society to which he chose to belong. Such an indulgence would abolish the partial distinctions of victory, and the Roman provincials might patiently acquiesce in the hardships of their condition, since it depended on themselves to assume the privilege, if they dared to assert the character, of free and warlike barbarians. Part 3. When justice inexorably requires the death of a murderer, each private citizen is fortified by the assurance that the laws, the magistrate, and the whole community are the guardians of his personal safety. But in the loose society of the Germans, revenge was always honorable and often meritorious. The independent warrior chastised or vindicated with his own hand the injuries which he had offered or received, and he had only to dread the resentment of the sons and kinsmen of the enemy whom he had sacrificed to his selfish or angry passions. The magistrate, conscious of his weakness, interposed not to punish, but to reconcile, and he was satisfied if he could persuade or compel the contending parties to pay and to accept the moderate fine which had been ascertained as the price of blood. The fierce spirit of the Franks would have opposed a more rigorous sentence. The same fierceness despised these ineffectual restraints, and when their simple manners had been corrupted by the wealth of Gaul, the public peace was continually violated by acts of hasty or deliberate guilt. In every just government the same penalty is inflicted, or at least is imposed, for the murder of a peasant or a prince. But the national inequality established by the Franks in their criminal proceedings was the last insult and abuse of conquest. In the calm moments of legislation they solemnly pronounced that the life of a Roman was of smaller value than that of a barbarian. The antrustion, a name expressive of the most illustrious birth or dignity among the Franks, was appreciated at the sum of 600 pieces of gold, while the noble provincial who was admitted to the king's table might be legally murdered at the expense of 300 pieces. 200 were deemed sufficient for a Frank of ordinary condition, but the meaner Romans were exposed to disgrace and danger by trifling